Good morning. You're listening to the KPCW Local News Hour. I'm Christine Weller, filling in for Leslie Thatcher. It is 8:06 on this Tuesday, November 25th. Traffic is picking up near Kimball Junction already, so if you're traveling into town, be aware of that. And as far as weather, we've got 25 degrees Fahrenheit in the Heber area. The high today is 45 degrees. In Park City, it is 26 with a high of 40 degrees. And we've got ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes here for a more in-depth weather update.
Happy Tuesday, KPCW listeners. It's time for a look at your Wasatch Back forecast on this Tuesday. We're looking at mostly sunny to partly sunny skies as we go throughout today. We're behind a weak front that moved through, so that's going to bring in some slightly cooler temperatures to the area. So we're looking at high temperatures only around 40 degrees for us this afternoon in Park City. We'll see those highs only in the mid-40s in the Heber Valley. So you'll notice a little bit of an extra chill in the air, but not too bad. It's right about where we should be for this time of the year. As we go into your Wednesday, that short chill will be just that, a short chill, because we start to warm it back up. Look for a mixture of sun and clouds. We'll call it partly cloudy skies for your Wednesday. Temperatures starting off into the 20s in Park City and the Heber Valley. We'll see those high temperatures climbing into the mid to upper 40s in Park City. High temperatures will climb into the low 50s for us in the Heber Valley. As we move into your Thursday, look for plenty of sunshine. Temperatures once again back down into the 20s to kick off the day. As we go throughout your Thursday afternoon, high temperatures climb into the low 50s. In Park City, we'll see those highs climbing into the mid-50s in the Heber Valley. Once we get to it, your Friday, we'll be looking at, again, partly cloudy skies. Temperatures will be into the upper 20s to low 30s to kick off the day. But your Friday is looking pretty nice with highs in the mid-40s for Park City, highs in the low 50s as we get towards your Heber Valley. Now, we got some big changes heading our way. A cold front moves in as we go into your weekend. So Saturday, we start off in the low to mid-20s for morning temperatures. We only warm up in the upper 30s in Park City with low to mid-40s in the Heber Valley. We'll also be looking at increasing chances for a few rain or snow showers mixed together, moving in Saturday afternoon into Saturday evening. But we get much colder as we go into your Saturday night and Sunday morning. Morning low temperatures dip down into the low 20s across both Park City and the Heber Valley. That means any moisture will be all snow showers, and those snow showers will continue into your Sunday afternoon with highs remaining below freezing in Park City and highs only in the upper 30s in the Heber Valley, and a big chill by the time we kick off next week with morning lows in the teens. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
It is 8:10 on this Tuesday morning. I'm Christine Weller filling in for Leslie Thatcher. Coming up on the Local News Hour this morning, the Salt Lake City International Airport's Nancy Vollmer has what to expect if you're traveling over Thanksgiving and the latest updates to the airport. Then Utah Avalanche Center's Liam McDonald and Caroline Miller share life-saving information during the 7th Annual Avalanche Awareness Week ahead of the ski season. And the Wasatch County Health Department talks about the county's measles outbreak and how to stay healthy this holiday season. Let's jump into some local news. A developer says it could make its affordable housing even more affordable if Summit County lets it sell market rate homes. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports the type of housing built at Klein Dolly could change.
Summit County has chosen Columbus Pacific Development to create housing and a new fire station and recreation field house in Jeremy Ranch. The 30 county-owned acres, about half of them developable, are next to Jeremy Ranch Elementary and referred to as the Klein Dolly Parcel. The developer's initial proposal had all 172 housing units deed-restricted for certain incomes, meaning renters and owners would need to earn below a certain threshold to qualify for the housing. Columbus Pacific's Tony Tyler presented the admittedly controversial case November 19th for making the most expensive housing potentially more expensive. His original proposal had housing for people making anywhere from 30% to 150% of Summit County's median income, which for a family of four is almost $169,000. But Tyler acknowledges families making 120 or 150% may not want to buy a home with income restrictions tied to it, since they limit the home's resale value.
From a real estate value perspective, investment perspective, the less likely it is that they're going to live here.
Tyler's question for the Summit County Council was whether it wants to convert 22 homes for those higher earners from deed restricted to outright market rate.
Someone that makes 200 grand a year, if they don't already or want to live in Summit County and buy into a market rate product of some kind, they are more likely to purchase a home in Wasatch County or Salt Lake County.
If he can sell 22 homes at the market rate, Tyler says the lower income housing can be more affordable by comparison. The council didn't decide which route was better November 19th. Columbus Pacific says it can build the project in whichever manner the county prefers, since its bottom line wouldn't change. Columbus Pacific has previously experimented with deed restrictions. It's renting out the second phase of Slopeside Village in Canyons Village at the market rate, but tenants must be employed within Summit County. Since winning the bid to develop the Kleindali parcel last summer, Columbus Pacific's been working with some Summit County staff and council members in a private subcommittee. Speaking with the entire council November 19th, Tyler says the next steps are to sign a formal agreement to negotiate and prepare a joint development application next month. The application would involve a rezone. He proposed a new zone, NMU-2, a nod to the existing neighborhood mixed-use zone called NMU-1. Councilmember Chris Robinson, who's in the subcommittee talks, says creating a new zone is, quote, crucial for the project's viability. He and Tyler agreed that because any other property owner could apply for the new zone, it should be carefully designed so it won't be abused. Columbus Pacific and Summit County are financial supporters of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
On the phone with us is the Salt Lake City International Airport's Nancy Vollmer. She's here to discuss what to expect if you're traveling over Thanksgiving and the latest updates to the airport. Hi, Nancy.
Oh, good morning, Christine. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. So a record number of people are expected to travel within the U.S. this Thanksgiving. What is the Salt Lake City Airport expecting?
So we are definitely preparing for an increase in passenger traffic, but it won't be a record breaker. Two of our busiest days will be Wednesday, and that's the day, you know, just prior to the Thanksgiving holiday, when we will expect about 30,000 passengers to come through the front door and just as many to arrive, people who are visiting Utah. And then the busiest day after Thanksgiving will be that Sunday. And again, we'll expect about 30,000 passengers to go through screening on those days and those numbers, the same number of passengers to arrive. So it will be busy, no doubt, but it won't be a record breaker for us. It's very comparable to what the numbers were last year at this time.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit more about how the airport prepares for an influx of travelers?
Sure. So we have projections that we look at for the number of passengers that will be coming in through screening. We work closely with TSA, and once we see the days that will be the busiest, we definitely make sure that everyone is aware of that, so our concessions know about it and our other airline partners, just so we can make sure that we're staffed up and ready for the increase in passengers. What we do is we look at everything from curb to gate and how we can make the passenger experience more enjoyable. So, for example, what we're doing for Wednesday is we have a number of performers that are scheduled, and we have everything from jazz music to guitar players, just to create a calming and travel environment. We also already have our holiday decor up and have been getting some really positive comments about that. So those are a couple of things that we do just to make the passengers feel more comfortable when they're traveling through the airport when it's a little bit busier.
Yeah, I know I always like seeing the nutcrackers at the airport when I'm traveling around the holidays. As far as the traveler side, do you have any tips for people traveling this week on how to make their trip through the airport the smoothest?
Absolutely, and I think the best tip that I can give is just to prepare in advance. So, for example, look at what you're taking in your carry-on bag. Look on the TSA.gov website to make sure you're not bringing anything that's not allowed, because if there are any delays at the security checkpoint, that impacts all the passengers. So also arrive 2 hours prior to your flight if you're flying domestically, and 3 hours when you're traveling internationally, because that just gives you enough time to find parking, to go through security screening, you know, to get checked in, and then to make your way to the gate. And a lot of people, I don't think, are aware, too, that you can reserve your parking in advance. So that just takes out the uncertainty of finding an airport parking place, and you can find that information on slcairport.com. So beyond that, I would say, you know, be sure that you check with your airline's app or the website the website for your flight status, because even though the weather is beautiful here in Salt Lake City, on the East Coast or other parts of the country, the weather may be disruptive, and so that could impact your flight. So just to make sure that your flight's on time, it hasn't been delayed, check with the airline's app or even the airport's app to find out what the status of your flight is.
Okay. And I know the Federal Aviation Administration lifted its directive calling for an emergency reduction flights. That was during the government shutdown. Are there any lingering impacts at the airport?
You know, we really haven't seen any. Everything is pretty much back to normal. We did have, you know, some flights that were canceled, as you well know, during that federal government shutdown. But once that was lifted, all of the flights were reinstated. We have a full staff with TSA. So, you know, we really are not seeing any impacts from that federal shutdown.
Okay. And I know you said this week is not expected to be, you know, break any records. Can you speak to how busy Thanksgiving week is compared to around Christmas time?
Yeah, it's hard to say for this coming Christmas because we just don't have the numbers yet. But just to give your listeners an idea, usually the busiest time here at the airport is during the ski season. So usually if it's President's Day holiday, we typically see some of our biggest numbers during that time. I think one of the busiest days that we saw since we've been in the new airport was when we hosted the NBA All-Star Games. So if there's a big event, if we have a big dump of snow, which I know we're all hoping for, you know, we'll start seeing the numbers of skiers come in, and that really ups our numbers. So even though, again, we're busy around the holidays, we usually don't see those record-breaking numbers unless there's a special event or if, you know, we have some skiers coming into town.
Okay. And I know you also had some updates to the airport. What can you share with us there?
We sure have. So last October, we opened up more gates and more concessions. So anyone who is traveling to the airport, I suggest you allow a few extra minutes and go to Concourse B and to the east side, because we have now a Moab Brewery that's located there. We have an aubergine. We also have a Artist Aesthetics store and a Utah National Park store. And then we have opened two additional sensory rooms. So we have one located on Concourse A and then two sensory rooms on Concourse B. And those are designed for individuals who may need a break or a quieter environment when they're traveling through the airport. And then we also have two new lounges that opened up in Concourse B. So we have an American Express Centurion Club that's now open. And then Delta opened up a second Sky Club in Concourse B. And the entrance to that is located just by Alley the Allosaurus, which is something we installed about a year ago. And one other thing I wanted to mention, too, as far as something that's new, is we have a new art installation. So on Concourse B West, we have a new installation by artist Gordon Huther, and it's called Swallows in Flight. And it's a beautiful installation showing outlines of swallows, and it's made out of a dichroic type of, it's not glass, it's like a plastic, similar to the Falls installation that passengers see when they enter the airport. So during the day, there's different colors that it reflects just depending on where the sunlight is. So that's a really nice new installation there.
Okay. What's coming up for the airport? Is there any more construction, anything new coming up anytime soon?
Absolutely. So we are on our final approach, as we like to say, for the last phase of construction. So that will be phase four. That will open up on October 27th of 2026. We'll open up the final 11 gates along with six more concessions. We'll also open up another or install another art installation similar to the Swallows in Flight. But instead of outlines of birds, this will be outlines of aircraft, and that will be located at the end of Concourse B East. And then, of course, having a new airport where we have more capacity, we've been able to welcome new airlines and new flights. So, for example, we're very excited that next week on December 4th, we'll be starting a nonstop flight from Salt Lake City to Lima. So that's something that Delta announced, and it will be operating until January 25th. Our hope is that it will come back again next year for a longer period. And then we have two new routes that are going, that are nonstop, that will be going to beach resorts. So on the 19th of December, Kona will, Delta will begin their nonstop flight to Kona. And then on the 20th, there's a nonstop flight that Delta is beginning to Fort Myers. So there's some new flights that are coming in, and we're always working with the airlines on bringing in new routes and also working with other airlines that are not here currently to recruit them to Salt Lake City, just to, you know, help increase the number of routes that we have from Salt Lake City. So with our international route map, that's really been growing. And last June, we started a nonstop to Incheon in Seoul, South Korea. So that's been a very popular route as well. So a lot of new options for travelers wanting to do nonstop flights.
Great. Is there anything else you think our listeners should know?
I think the only thing I would suggest is if you haven't traveled recently, just remember that you are required to have a real ID now or another acceptable form of ID, such as a passport. So just make sure that you've got the appropriate ID before you come to the airport. And we have a new app that we just launched yesterday at the airport. So you can download that at SLC International. It has a great navigational map. Also, it has information on what the wait times are. So it's something I think that our travelers will really appreciate and enjoy.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We've been speaking with Nancy Vollmer. She's part of the Salt Lake City International Airports team. We will be right back after this. Olympic officials have just released a new name and logo as they count down the Winter Games' return to Utah in 2034. KPCW's Sydney Weaver has the details.
Utah now has 3,000 days, or 8 years, until the Olympics return to the state. Standing in Utah's gateway to the world, the Salt Lake City International Airport, Governor Spencer Cox unveiled the game's new title that represents the entire state, not just the capital. Utah 2034.
This isn't just the Salt Lake Olympics. It's not just the Wasatch Front Olympics. This is our Olympics. It's all of us together.
Also at the Utah 2034 naming ceremony Monday, officials unveiled a new art installation that will greet athletes, teams, sport leaders, and fans over the next 8 years and beyond. Utah 2034 Vice Chair Steve Starks says the design represents the landforms of the American West and the state's 29 counties working together in unity as one community to welcome the world.
The remarkable visual landscapes that are found in Utah from the south with the red rocks and canyonlands.
A 12-foot-tall piece titled Utah Together Spectacular will greet travelers in Gordon Huther's The Canyon, the white wavy center of the airport. In a partnership with LA 28, the host of the next summer games, and the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee, Utah 2034 also announced its first line of apparel. The new clothing line is available online and will soon be available at Utah Legacy venue locations and the Team USA shops. Sydney Weaver, KPCW News.
And the Utah Avalanche Center's Leah McDonald and Caroline Miller are on the phone to share life-saving information during the 7th Annual Avalanche Awareness Week ahead of the ski season. Hi, welcome both of you.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. The 7th Annual Avalanche Awareness Week is here. Can you give us first, we'll start with Caroline, give us kind of an overview of what Avalanche Awareness Week is.
Yeah, absolutely. We're thrilled to be here. So Avalanche Awareness Week, this is the 7th year, like you mentioned. Avalanche Awareness Week was deemed by the Utah State legislation 7 years ago that the first week of December annually will be celebrated to remind folks about the importance of avalanche awareness, avalanche education across the state, and also remembering those who have lost their lives due to avalanche incidents. So we take the opportunity each year to bring a series of events to life in that spirit, not just in the Salt Lake and Park City areas, but across the entire state of Utah.
Okay, and I know that there are events at universities and recreation areas throughout Utah. Can you give us a little more detail of what people are learning there and kind of what those sessions consist of?
Yeah, I can answer that. We've got events throughout the state for the whole week, and a lot of the events are kind of aimed at giving people some foundational knowledge on avalanches and avalanche safety. But then we also have some events that will be great for experienced users, especially the Utah Snow and Avalanche Workshop, which is Saturday.
Okay. And I know that avalanche rescue dogs are also at some of those events. Can you share a little bit more about how those dogs help with rescues and kind of what people will be learning about with those dogs?
Yeah, so the avalanche dogs are really used in cases where people don't have the proper equipment to dig someone out of an avalanche. So the dogs have really strong noses and they're able to find people under the snow. And they'll be at the Sugar House Park kickoff party, which is next Monday, December 1st from 4 to 7 p.m. And at that event, we'll also have a life flight helicopter in the park. We'll have stations to practice with your beacon and some wilderness medicine skills, as well as a lot of other organizations like Search and Rescue, Wasatch Backcountry Rescue, that are there to give everyone information.
Okay. And so what are some of the basic avalanche safety tips that you will be sharing at these events?
Yeah, so we cover a variety of different topics. It's important that folks understand that avalanche education is a lifelong journey. So we endeavor to meet both new users and very experienced users where they're at. As Liam mentioned, at our Sugar House Park kickoff event on Monday from 4 to 7 at Sugar House Park in Salt Lake, we'll be doing beacon drills, working with people to understand how their avalanche transceiver works and how they use it effectively to find people buried in the snow. We'll also have stations such as first aid and emergency response, so folks can learn a little bit more some of the rudimentary skills needed in the event of unburying a partner from an avalanche. And then throughout the week, we have a presentation, for example, at Lone Pine Gear Exchange, also in Salt Lake, where we'll hear from a professional climber about risk perception and their mindset shift and how they approach larger objectives. Then throughout the rest of the week, we have a number of Know Before You Goes, which discusses, you know, how to access the information as well as the tools to get into the backcountry. And then finally, as Liam mentioned, the Utah Snow and Avalanche Workshop on Saturday, that all cultivates with a variety of speakers providing updates on industry research, risk management tools for new users and experienced users, and tales from experienced backcountry users of all sorts of different modalities, meaning skiers, snowmobilers. So there's really something for everything next week.
Okay. How many people do you usually have attending these events?
Great question. It really depends on...
Sorry.
I'm sorry. It really depends on which event. You know, at the Sugar House kickoff party, we've had anywhere from 50 people to 300 people come to that. And the Know Before You Go presentations, depending where they are, can generally be like 30 to 70 people going to those presentations.
Okay. And I know I did want to talk a little bit about what we might be seeing in the backcountry this winter season. Early season conditions have a big impact on avalanche frequency and behavior later in the season. I know this year it's been kind of a mild early season with not much snowfall around the Wasatch back. Does this mean that we might not have some of those persistent weak layers that we had last year? Can maybe Caroline, can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So in short, it's certainly a dynamic season. Even when it seems like there's not much snow down in the valley floors or in our yards. There is some snow up in the hills on various aspects, and that can lead to a variety of outcomes once more snow comes. So in short, there are lots of different conditions happening right now across the state. For example, up in Logan and some of the Bear River Range, quite a bit more snow has fallen recently. I was out with some of our staff a couple days ago when we were noticing some snow up high. So in short, what that means is the situation is always dynamic, and each range and different aspects and elevations are always experiencing different conditions. It's important that folks visit UtahAvalancheCenter.org and review the forecast, understand how to read the forecast, and look at observations for people who are traveling in the zones that they like to recreate in. Because like I said, even if there's not much snow down low, there is snow throughout the rest of the state, and how each storm interacts with the next is unique. So absolutely stay tuned to our website to read about what people are experiencing in the field and what that looks like.
Yeah, and you guys have daily forecasts when the season is in full swing, right?
Yep, that's correct. So our forecasters are already on staff, and they are performing field days and making updates regularly. And then as soon as the team deems necessary, we'll start issuing the daily forecast. But once we start those, we like to continue those every day. They're a 24-hour product, so it will be not long until you see that daily forecast issued.
Okay, and that's definitely something backcountry visitors should check on always before they go in the backcountry. I also wanted to ask about Big Cottonwood is closed today for avalanche artillery testing. Are these the new remote detonators that we've seen in Little Cottonwood, or what's kind of going on in Big Cottonwood?
Yeah, there's a variety of different projects that UDOT and Cottonwood Canyons have going on. We work alongside UDOT, but they are a separate entity, so I can't speak to exactly what they have going on today. But it's important that when UDOT and any of the Cottonwood Canyons groups discuss road closures, that people understand that it's important to stay apprised of those updates and stay out of their way. The CottonwoodCanyons.UDOT website is fantastic resource to stay up to date on what's going on there. But typically this time of year, they begin doing their test firing, which allows them to make sure that their equipment is up to date for the year, whether that's the more state-of-the-art remote avalanche control systems or older systems that they've been using for quite some time.
Okay. And I kind of wanted to circle back around. We talked a little bit about how the avalanche situation is pretty dynamic. I know that southern Utah has received a little bit more snow than up north here this year. Can you speak to what the avalanche outlook down south might be?
Sure. Similar to what I described up here in the Salt Lake region, you know, there's dry and sunny skies ahead for the next few days. And so every time there's a storm in the forecast, the forecasters are keeping an eye on how the old snow will interact with the new snow. So there certainly is, and talking to some of my team earlier this week, folks were for skiing on known grassy slopes down there because it's still quite thin. But as we say, if there's enough snow to ride, there's enough snow to slide. So it's just important that as folks head down even to southern Utah, where there is a bit more ground cover right now, they keep in mind that dry spells can cause various snow conditions that can make it more challenging later. So definitely keep an eye on the Moab and Abajo's area forecasts if you are planning to head down to southern Utah this time of year.
Okay. Is there anything else you think we should know about Avalanche Awareness Week or the season outlook?
In general, we're super excited for all of our events. I'll let Liam recap some of the events that are just around the corner. But just the last thing that I would say is that the Utah Avalanche Center is so grateful for the support of the community, and the community really keeps our mission alive. So attendance at these events is so important to helping proliferate the mission of the Utah Avalanche Center. And Liam, if you could just speak to a couple of the events happening early next week, that would be great.
Yeah, and one thing I'll say before that is I think now is it a great time to really refresh some of the skills that we may know or learn some new avalanche skills, especially with it being so dry here in Salt Lake in the central Wasatch. If people are listening and they're itching for more snow, a great way to get over those blues a little bit is practice some avalanche skills. So we've got, I think, kind of a rundown of the events we've got, and please you can check out our website utahavalanchecenter.org with a full list of events and times and where they'll be. But on Monday, December 1st, we'll have the Sugar House kickoff party with rescue skills, medical skills, some Abbey dogs, and a helicopter to look at. On Tuesday, we've got our Pray for Snow party at the Cache in Logan. And that's kind of our Logan fundraiser party. And we get a lot of local Loganites out there. Wednesday, we've got that Billy Haas presentation that Caroline mentioned about the mindset shift at Lone Pine. And then we've got Know Before You Go presentations on Wednesday in Moab at SUU, Utah State University, and Weber State University. Thursday, we've got we're doing a Pine Brook Beacon Park opening. So especially for Park City locals, if you didn't know, we have a free Beacon Park set up in Pine Brook, right by the Park City Day School. And that's up all winter, and it's free to use, and there's instructions on how to use it, but it's basically a free resource to practice your searching with your beacon. And so we'll have that on Thursday, where we'll show people how to use it and do some practicing. And then we've also got Know Before You Go presentations December 5th at Beaver and Southern Utah University. And then the final thing is Saturday, the annual Utah Snow and Avalanche Workshop. And that'll be, Caroline, remind me which high school auditorium?
It's at Wasatch Junior High School in Mill Creek.
Thank you. Yeah. And that's a great place to just get some more broader knowledge on what avalanche professionals are doing, what the industry is researching, and some stories and case studies. Really good place to get some more information if you're interested.
Great. Well, thank you both so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having us.
We've been speaking with the Utah Avalanche Center's Caroline Miller and Liam McDonald. The Park City area resorts have been blowing snow when the weather allows, while temperatures continue to thwart opening days across the state. KPCW's Connor Thomas went to Park City Mountain to dig into the science of snowmaking.
Park City Mountain turned on the snow guns October 27th, and it's been touch and go since then. When winter doesn't arrive as planned, ski areas still need help from Mother Nature to blow machine-made snow. Mild temperatures have forced many northern Utah resorts, like Park City, to push back opening days. The resort says it's watching for the snowmaking window it needs to start the season. Temperatures are only one part of that equation. Better science and better technology means snowmakers like Park City's Barrett Burkert get a wider window if they watch the humidity as well.
You know, when I started making snow way back in the day, we hung thermometers off of trees, and if it was 32 degrees, we tried to make snow. But now, you know, you can make snow if it's 34 degrees, if it's really low humidity. So
snowmakers now measure wet bulb, a combination of the air temperature and the moisture in it. The higher the humidity, the colder it has to be to make good snow. That's because snow guns are actually more like water guns, using compressed air to spray liquid that has to freeze before it falls. The resulting snow is less flaky and more like Dippin' Dots. It makes for a hard and sturdy base, but some skiers prefer the natural stuff because it's more forgiving. Wet bulb is measured in degrees, but because it factors in humidity, wet bulb seldom equals temperature. Park City Mountain says it needs 28 degrees wet bulb to blow snow, and 15 degrees wet bulb is ideal. According to a preseason newsletter, early November has averaged 24 degrees wet bulb in the past 3 years. This year, it's been 44. Park City Mountain has yet to announce a new opening day. Vail Resort's Epic Promise Foundation is a financial supporter of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
I've got the Wasatch County Health Department's Jonelle Fitzgerald and Eric Christensen here on Zoom to talk about the county's measles outbreak and how to stay healthy this holiday season. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning. Thanks for having us on.
Good morning.
So I first wanted to just talk about the health department announced on Saturday there were 5 confirmed measles cases in local high school students, and the department was waiting on 2 other test results. Do we have any updates there?
Actually, yes. So we just received those test results back this morning, and both tested positive. So at this point, and we haven't even had time to check in with our team to learn more about those cases, other than that they were positive.
Okay. I know we know a little bit about where the D's spread from. Can you just remind our listeners about kind of where this, where the measles outbreak kind of, or not outbreak, but, you know, where this kind of came from?
Sure. Well, we received information back that we did have a positive hit in a wastewater sample on November 6th. And when we saw that, you know, that could be just a visitor passing through. We didn't know if it was a resident. That doesn't really tell us anything about, you know, how many people or you know, how much virus is going around in the community. It just tells us that there is some. So we were on the lookout at that time and thought something would probably pop up. And then just late last week, we did learn about the 5 positive cases, all at Wasatch High School. So those are all Wasatch High School students. The additional 2 cases that were pending and suspected that came back through positive this morning are also Wasatch High School students. So we don't know where these high school students became infected. We can't find a common source, but suspect that probably they, well, who knows, but it probably was acquired at the high school because the associated cases are all there at this time.
Okay. Can you share a little bit more about some tips now that we've got 7 students testing positive? How can the community help prevent the spread of measles?
MMR vaccine is the best way to protect yourself from measles. It's very effective, 97% effective. So if you've got the vaccine, your risk of acquiring measles is very low. And because of that, our recommendation is that unvaccinated students at Wasatch High School don't go to school from the last known exposure date, which at this time is November 18th.
Okay. Eric, I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine. How far apart are doses given? How safe is it? Kind of give us an overview.
The vaccine is a very effective vaccine. As Jonelle had mentioned, 2 doses of the MMR vaccine are 97% effective at preventing measles. One dose is 93% effective. And so it's very uncommon for people who are vaccinated to get measles for this. The vaccine in and of itself is very safe. There are not very many complications that come from that. And so with those rates, it's we do recommend people, if you've had exposure to someone with measles, to get the MMR vaccine. If you get that within 72 hours, that can provide prevention and of you either getting the infection or having or and reducing the symptoms of the infection. So getting that vaccine can be very helpful during this time, especially as we're going into this time of gathering for Thanksgiving. That'll be very effective at preventing spread.
Okay. Go ahead. Do you have anything else to add?
So, you know, with these are, the vaccine is available for children over the age of 12 months. We don't give it for pregnant women who are pregnant, but otherwise can be a very safe vaccine to get.
Okay. Do you know anything about vaccine cost or about what about for those who are uninsured about how they can get the vaccine if they're interested in getting it?
So I can cover that. We have vaccine here and available at the health department. Insurance covers vaccine costs, so that's the cost is free to a person because it's covered by their insurance. If a person is uninsured, we also have programs that can allow for a low-cost vaccine or possibly a free vaccine, depending on insurance and income status. So come and get your vaccine, whether it's here at the health department, whether it's with your healthcare provider, or local pharmacies also have vaccine available.
Okay. And Eric, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about what herd immunity is and how much of the community in Wasatch County is vaccinated against measles, mumps, and, you know, has that measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. Can you share us, tell us a little bit more about what that is?
Yeah, herd immunity is the concept of when there are multiple people who are immunized, it provides kind of a barrier to prevent the spread. So as discussed earlier, the people who are double vaccinated have a 97% chance of not getting measles. And that then essentially prevents the spread to those around them. People who are not vaccinated have a 90% chance of getting measles. So there's higher risk of people who are not vaccinated of getting it and then potentially spreading that. So herd immunity is essentially where there are large groups of people who are vaccinated that prevents the spread. Typically numbers for that are around 95% has strong protection rate of herd immunity. If the community has 95% or higher, that's considered very strong. The high school and the rates in this general population are 90+ percent. The high school is about 92% of a vaccination rate. So those are pretty high rates. That's wonderful. And we encourage people to continue to get the vaccine that can provide that protection as far as from spreading it further.
And I did hear that a couple of the students were vaccinated who tested positive. Is that right?
Correct. We see that in these types of infections. The vaccine is not perfect, right? It's not 100% effective against that. We do see outbreaks even in people who are not or who are fully vaccinated. And that's just a statistical reality as far as with those vaccines. Also in cases where people have exposure to higher viral counts, there is chance of that overwhelming the immune system. And these, you know, nationally we see these outbreaks or cases of measles and double vaccinations, you know, nationally. That's consistent with other outbreaks as well. It's just not a perfect vaccine. But I do want to comment that the vaccine does reduce symptoms, right? It's not as severe, right, in those who are double vaccinated. So there is significant benefit really in getting the vaccine.
Okay.
I would also add that we know that a person who is vaccinated, even if they have a breakthrough case, are less likely to spread the virus as well.
Okay, good to know. I did also want to put this in kind of a broader context. Utah has seen almost 100 confirmed measles cases this year, and there have been more than 1,700 nationwide. The disease was previously considered to be eradicated in the U.S. Why are we seeing more cases now? Maybe
I would say just because of less vaccination status. So 10 years ago, we did have herd immunity at 95% or more, and now we don't have that. It's hard to know. We have good immunity among our older folks because measles circulated back in their day. So it's hard to say exactly what immunity looks like in our community as a whole. But vaccine was much more prominent 10 years ago. And so we didn't see as much spread of measles.
Okay. The last thing I wanted to ask about is measles is a reportable disease. And I was wondering if you could, maybe Eric can share what that means for a disease to be reportable.
A reportable disease is something that then is tracked essentially through CDC. It's identified as something important enough that we track those cases and be aware of them to help prevent spread. And so that's what that essentially means. It's making sure that we're aware of where those cases are and try to ultimately work to prevent additional outbreaks and spread of those diseases.
Okay. Is there anything else you think our listeners should know?
So partially the reason that measles is a reportable disease is because it's nothing to joke about, right? Measles is a very serious illness, and we hope to protect our population by getting folks a vaccine. So please reach out to us. Come and get vaccinated.
Okay. Any last?
Also, maybe be careful around the holidays, right? We're going to be joining families for Thanksgiving, and it's not just measles. No one wants to be sick at all. So if you're sick, stay home.
Okay. Any last thoughts, Eric?
I just want to reinforce that the medical community is here to help, and we want to be able to help people either prevent the spread of this or treat if there are concerns that are going on. If you are having symptoms of that are related to measles, we do ask as far as that you communicate beforehand either to the emergency room or to your primary care office that you suspect that there may be measles. That way the hospital or the office can prepare to get a sample and safely test. And so we just asked as far as to communicate if that's what the concern is beforehand so that we can prepare. But we are here to help and want to address whatever concerns people are having.
Okay. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with the Wasatch County Health Department's Janelle Fitzgerald and Eric Christian about the county's measles outbreak and how to stay healthy this holiday season. The Utah Department of Transportation will close Guardsman Pass from Summit County to the Wasatch County line this week. State Route 224 will close for the season at 7 a.m. Wednesday, November 26th, ending access for cars through the winter. Guardsman Pass from Brighton to Park City, State Route 190, closed earlier this month. UDOT has also closed American Fork Canyon and the Alpine Loop for the season, along with Mount Holly in Beaver County. Transportation officials have not yet announced a closing date for Mirror Lake Highway. Utah's seasonal roads will reopen in spring 2026.